Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 5th, 2006. Our session today is entitled Genetic Screening and Genetic Selection. Our presenter is Jan Chalupny, session number CHJA 2006-7. Let's listen in.
So this session is actually two sessions crammed together because there were no sessions on Tuesday. So whereas last week I did a separate session on genetic testing and a separate session on genetic selection, I'm trying to combine them both this week because I'm missing a day. So we'll see how that goes. We'll cover what we can cover. Feel free to ask questions. We'll define a few terms to begin with and then do some case studies. Okay, well, I guess I'll get started. My name is Jan Chalupny. I'm a research biologist, a molecular biologist. I do genetic research at a company called Amgen, which is a biotech slash pharmaceutical type of company. And so this session is about genetic testing, screening, and selection. And just as a, probably a number of you may have seen me wearing this on my head yesterday. It's actually not a hat. It's a model of DNA. So when we're talking about genetic selection or genetic screening or genetic testing, we're talking about looking at the molecular level in the DNA in the nucleus of our cells and determining whether an individual has a specific gene or set of genes and what the sequence of those genes are, what the sequence of the DNA is. So this represents DNA. DNA has a sugar and phosphate backbone to which there are attached molecules called bases. And they have names. They're abbreviated A, G, C, and T. So it's kind of a four-letter code that so the genes contain all the information for building all the proteins that do the things in our cells. So the genes are like a cookbook or an instruction book. They have the instructions. They don't actually do things themselves in the sense of active participation in any process, but they provide the instructions. And so an A always binds to a T, and a G always binds to a C, and so these two strands are mirror images of each other, and they come apart, and then something called RNA, which is very similar to DNA, is synthesized off one strand, and then that RNA is what's used in the cell to figure out how to build the protein. And every three bases in a gene encodes one amino acid, and amino acids are what proteins are made of. They're put together, you can think of them kind of as a string of beads. They don't stay in one long string, they kind of fold up and twist and have their own shape, the proteins. But the instructions for the proteins are encoded in the DNA, and the DNA has a double helical form. So that's just sort of a brief DNA introduction, since we're going to be talking about genes. And genes are made of DNA, but there's a lot of DNA, and they reside on the chromosomes. The chromosomes are huge stretches of DNA, and there are genes on that DNA, and then there's DNA in between the genes that is not a gene. So all genes are DNA, but not all DNA is a gene. Okay, so when we talk about genetic testing, that refers to testing individuals for expression of specific alleles. An allele is just another word for a variety of a gene. Okay, so for every gene in the human genome, we each have two copies, one on each chromosome, one which we receive from our mother and one which we receive from our father. And they may be slightly different, right? So if your father gives you the gene for brown eyes and your mother gives you the gene for blue eyes, you're going to have brown eyes because the brown eye gene is dominant over the blue eye gene. But your two eye color genes are slightly different, so they can have slightly different spellings depending on what gene you're talking about. So that's what's called an allele. And so in some genetic diseases, the allele that causes the disease is dominant. So if you have only one copy of that, you may be sick. In some cases, it's recessive, and you need both, two copies of the disease, of the allele that encodes the protein that doesn't function properly and causes disease. So that's what you're looking for in genetic testing. That's of individuals. Genetic screening refers to testing whole populations for the presence or absence of specific alleles. And then genetic selection refers to selecting specific traits that in an organism that you want. Okay, so we've been doing that. Humans have been practicing genetic selection for hundreds of years through selective breeding of crops and animals. These days, genetic selection can be done in a much more direct way. And here I'm referring to situations in which there are more ethical questions. Genetic selection of human characteristics. So if you do in vitro fertilization, you can screen those blastocysts. It's kind of a term for when the egg and sperm meet and the sperm fertilizes the egg, that's a zygote. And then that cell undergoes a series of divisions and forms this hollow cellular ball where all the cells are essentially identical. They haven't begun to differentiate into different kinds of tissue. That's called a blastocyst. It's not really referred to as an embryo at that stage. So at that stage, you can take a few cells out and look at the DNA in the nuclei of those cells, and you can screen for certain conditions. Okay, so that will be, if we get to it, we'll be looking at a case study for that, because that has actually been done in the U.S. as well as in Britain, and perhaps in other countries. I'm not sure exactly how many countries have that capability are actually allowing people to do that. So all of these can be looked at as a form of eugenics. And probably everybody's familiar with the term eugenics. There's one sort of situation that is brought to mind most commonly when one discusses eugenics. Does anyone want to shout out what you think of when you think of eugenics? So eugenics is the practice of trying to improve the gene pool through an active process. So a social theory that holds out the promise of improving the genetic endowment of human beings by encouraging people with more desirable traits to reproduce and discouraging or preventing those with less desirable traits from doing so.
Nazi Germany?
Exactly, yeah, that's the scenario that most often comes to mind. Nazi Germany, where you decide, or you know, a government decides that a certain population is not desirable, and in order to prevent them from passing on their undesirable traits, they essentially eliminated them as best they could through genocide. So genocide is a very extreme form of eugenics, potentially not always done for that reason, but that's what we often think of. So there are both positive and negative forms of eugenics. So the positive form, and by positive and negative, I'm not implying good or bad, but positive is where you encourage people with what you consider desirable traits to pass on their traits. And negative eugenics would be where you discourage people that have what you believe to be less desirable traits from passing on those traits. Ethical questions for either testing, eugenics, whatever, who are the appropriate decision makers? Who decides what's a positive trait and what's a negative trait? So there are a number of different types of ways that one can positively or negatively select specific traits. Eugenic immigration policies, who you allow into the country. Involuntary sterilization programs. Genetic screening, where you try to identify in a population who has what traits and then discriminate against those people on that basis. And our country has engaged in all of these possible eugenic practices. So I'm quoting here from a book called Exploding the Gene Map, which is written by a scientist named Ruth Hubbard and a writer named Elijah Wald. And I think there's at least one copy of this in the bookstore. So it's a very thought-provoking book, especially for myself as a molecular biologist, to really identify how much we focus on genetics and how much power we give that versus what do genes really do and how much of human behavior is influenced by a lot of other things and not only your genetics. So in here it says, as early as 1897, the Michigan legislature considered and defeated a bill to sterilize people of quote-unquote bad heredity. And, you know, it doesn't say in here who was going to get to make the decision about who those people were. A subsequent compulsory sterilization bill aimed at quote-unquote idiots and imbecile children was passed by the Pennsylvania legislature in 1905, but vetoed by Governor Samuel Pennypacker, with the strong message that it was not only illogical, but violates the principle of ethics. The first compulsory sterilization law that was actually enacted passed the Indiana legislature in 1907. But even before that, in 1899, a Dr. Harry Sharp began to perform involuntary vasectomies at the Indiana State Reformatory at Jeffersonville on inmates whom he judged to be, quote-unquote, hereditary criminals or, quote, otherwise genetically defective, unquote. So you can also see from just this quote that this kind of thing is usually perpetrated upon people with less power than the perpetrators, right? So there's already a power inequity there. Who gets to decide who should be involuntarily sterilized or otherwise prevented from reproducing? So that's an example of involuntary sterilization. And for eugenic immigration policies, says, while the eugenicists diagnosed individuals with hereditary defects in virtually all ethnic groups, they found that certain groups had a much higher proportion of defectives than others. For this reason, eugenics was an explicit factor in the Immigration Restriction Act of 1924. This act was designed to decrease immigration to the United States from Southern and Eastern Europe so as to tilt the population balance in favor of U.S. residents of British and Northern European descent. The number of people allowed to immigrate into the United States from any country each year was restricted to 2% of the U.S. residents who had been born in that country as listed in the census of 1890. So 1890 is 34 years before this Immigration Restriction Act. That 34-year-old census date was chosen deliberately because it set as a baseline the composition of the U.S. population prior to the major immigrations from South and Eastern Europe at the end of the 19th century. In the 1930s and early 1940s, this legislation prevented the immigration of countless Jews who were attempting to flee the Nazis because they had been born in Eastern Europe. So that's a eugenic immigration policy example. And for genetic screening, the Sickle Cell Anemia Control Act, which I had never heard of, even though it was passed when I was 10 years old. In 1972, the U.S. Congress passed the Sickle Cell Anemia Control Act, and several states promptly instituted screening programs. So this was before they could really look at the sequence of the gene. They looked for the presence of the defective hemoglobin protein in these individuals. Okay, so this would pick up people that had two misspelled copies of the gene, as well as carriers, because the carriers would also have the defective protein, although not at as high a rate as the people who were truly sick from sickle cell disease, because they had two genes that both produced the protein that didn't act properly. Sickle cell anemia itself is usually diagnosed because it produces symptoms, so the screening programs were intended to detect carriers of the sickle cell trait. There was no provision for counseling, and often the difference between the disease and the carrier state was not made clear to the people who were being tested. As a result, people who were carriers became needlessly concerned about their health. In some places, sickle cell tests were made compulsory on entering school or before couples could get a marriage license, and some programs required people to pay for their own tests. In the early and mid-1970s, quote, almost all of the major airlines grounded or fired their employees with sickle cell trait, unquote. So that would include the people suffering from sickle cell disease and the people that were carriers. The U.S. Air Force Academy also instituted a policy to exclude sickle cell carriers until one trainee filed a lawsuit in 1979. All this was done on the unproved assumption that such carriers were less able than other people to withstand the stress of lowered oxygen levels at high altitudes. So the hemoglobin gene, which does not act properly in people with sickle cell disease, that's involved in carrying oxygen to your cells. So there was this assumption that if people had a protein that was misformed and wasn't carrying oxygen well, then these people would have problems at higher altitudes. That was never proven before this screening was carried out, and was later shown to be untrue. Some African-American sickle cell carriers reported being denied employment or insurance or having their insurance premiums raised. Because of vocal criticism, including accusations of genocide, large-scale screening for sickle cell traits stopped by the mid-1970s.
So, does it say what the school screenings and the test before marriage, what the goal was?
Just to identify people with that trait, people that were carriers of the sickle cell trait. I'm not sure if there was a further, there's probably language that said more than just that, that's not in this book.
Okay.
But the thought was that, you know, these people would perform less well in certain conditions. Although, why do you care when someone's entering school?
Well, that's what I'm trying to
think
about.
But again, I mean, who were the people being screened? People that carry sickle cell trait are largely of African descent. So it's again a power thing. A less powerful ethnic group is being screened because a more powerful ethnic group decides that they should be, and then discriminates against them on the basis of what's found. Okay, so that's just by way of introduction to eugenics and genetic testing. And now that we have the sequence of the human genome and the sequence of many genes within that genome, we're able to screen for a lot of other conditions that have a genetic basis. So I'll start with one of the case studies. This is a prenatal testing case study, and it's described in this publication by the ELCA called Genetics, Where Do We Stand as Christians? Which is it's a really nice little book that really gives all the information without too much scientific jargon. It has a section on genetics and then deals with a lot of other issues, not just genetic testing. And it can be obtained from the ELCA. If you go to elca.org and search on genetics, this will pop up and you can download it yourself. And I think they'll send you a free copy if you call them. So this case scenario involves a married couple, Sarah and Alan, and they're expecting. Sarah's 16 weeks pregnant, and she goes in to see her obstetrician and has a routine blood test. So anyone who's been pregnant knows that that's a pretty common occurrence. And then when the results of that blood test come back, it looks a little funny. They think, you know, she might be positive for a genetic problem, or her fetus might be positive. And so they give her a choice, you know, do you want to know? The only thing that can determine definitively if your fetus has this genetic problem is amniocentesis. So, you know, of course that throws you into a whirl when you're 16 weeks pregnant and you're assuming that everything's going fine, and all of a sudden there's a possibility that there might be a problem. So Sarah and Alan go to a genetic counselor, so that's good. They're referred to someone who can talk them through some of these issues. And they're not sure if they really want to know, but is it worse to not know? You know, is the anxiety of not knowing for the whole rest of the pregnancy going to be worse than knowing for sure? And so they decide to have amniocentesis done. So they do amniocentesis, and so that's where they stick a large needle into the womb of the mother and draw out some fluid, and there are cells from the mother in there and cells from the fetus, and so you can compare to cells of the mother to determine which cells are from the fetus, and you can look at the chromosomes and deduce whether the child has, and what they're afraid the child might have is Edwards syndrome, which is trisomy 18, which means three copies of chromosome 18 instead of two. So having an extra copy of a chromosome can cause problems. That's one of the things that causes Down syndrome as well, different chromosome. So this is a syndrome associated with the presence of an extra third number 18 chromosome. It occurs in approximately one out of every 8,000 live births and involves multiple abnormalities. Common characteristics include low birth weight, mental retardation, low set and malformed ears, small jaws, hand abnormalities, congenital heart disease, hernias, and others. Few infants survive beyond the first year. So they have the amniocentesis done, and the word comes back, not what the doctor says, is, or the genetic counselor, I know you were hoping to be reassured by the results, but the baby has an extra chromosome 18, which confirms Edwards syndrome. So this is devastating news to Sarah and Alan, and they have to decide what to do about it. There are a lot of choices. You know, what are some of the obvious choices that they could make based on this information? Right, they could decide to discontinue the pregnancy. It's 16 weeks in, so it's not too late for that if they would choose to go that route. So the other choice is that they could continue with the pregnancy and have the child and try to prepare themselves for what lies ahead.
At that point, that's a definitive diagnosis.
Yeah. Chromosome squashed, you can see the extra chromosome 18. It's definitive. There may be a range, I don't know a lot about Edwards syndrome, but especially with Down syndrome, there's a range of severity, and it tells you nothing about that, whether the disease will be less severe or more severe. I mean, it sounds from this blurb here that few infants survive beyond the first year, so I don't know what percentage would survive beyond or how far beyond. You know, in the case of Down syndrome, people with Down syndrome live much longer, fuller lives. But again, there's a range of severity that just knowing there's the extra chromosome there doesn't tell you anything about the severity.
Have we reached the technology or whatever where they can genetically engineer that kind of thing, like, for instance, take the gene out, and then what kind of age would you have to do that? How in the world would you ever do that?
That's what genetic selection is, okay? Once the child is developing, it's too late for that.
Yeah.
But when we look at the pre-implantation genetic diagnosis scenario, that's where things like that can be done, where you've got where the fertilization happens in vitro or in a test tube in a dish outside the body, and then the blastocysts develop in that laboratory environment rather than inside the mother, and then you can take some of those cells without harming the blastocyst, do genetic analysis, and see whether there's a third chromosome 18. And then in those kind of cases, you would not implant those blastocysts back in the mother. You would choose ones that didn't have it. That also raises ethical questions about, is that blastocyst, should it be considered as a full human person? Mm-hmm. So is that murder to throw it away, for instance? You can store it in a freezer, but what happens to it? But we'll get to that if we make it to the last scenario here. So there are a lot of difficult choices that this couple faces now.
I can't remember because it was 17 years ago now, but our first child, I think the doctor gave us the option to have
amniocentesis.
Well, no, the blood test.
The blood test.
Even, and so it was kind of like, if you want to do this blood test, then we can tell you if they have these problems, or if something shows up, then you can decide what to do about it. I remember driving back from the doctor's office with my wife discussing, we want to have the blood test to start the process.
Yes, right. And it doesn't, here it just starts with some blood had been drawn during Sarah's regular visit, blah, blah, blah. But the same thing was true for myself 11 years ago. Or 11 or 12 before I had my first child. They said, yeah, we'll do this. We can do this routine screening blood test that can pick up, abnormalities or a higher, if something looks a little funny, then you can go for the amniocentesis. And I remember thinking about that as well. And I went ahead and had that blood test done, and nothing showed up on there.
So I think we chose not to. I'm just curious now if the practice, 17 years later, is that that's a routine test, or if people still get the option.
As far as I know, people still get the option whether they want to have that or not.
They do.
I think my thought was that if there was something going on, I'd rather know about it earlier so that I could try and make whatever preparations. You know, not that there's a wrong or a right, you know, but if you're not considering potentially ending the pregnancy, you know, that the outcome would have been the same for both of us, that I was not considering ending a pregnancy. But that if I had that information, I'm like one of those people that wants to know. Like, I want to know the gender, even though, you know, when it came out, it would be male, female. But if I could know earlier, for no good reason, really, except that I just wanted to know. And those can be wrong sometimes, too, when they look, you know, they run around. Sometimes they tell you it's female, and it turns out to be male, or vice versa. So I figured I would, if something looked a little funny, I would probably do the amniocentesis and find out, and then try and do whatever I could to, quote-unquote, get ready as you can ever be for a child that's going to have a potentially serious challenge in their life, or maybe something that's really even potentially life-threatening.
I'm just wondering if more, now that this is, maybe it doesn't add any better, maybe things, I mean, because we, once again, we were just left to make this decision, which is, you know, number, it was tough. There wasn't much counseling. There wasn't. It was. I mean, I just remember it was very weird.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree, and that's why I think it's good to discuss these kind of things, because the more you know about it, the more you'd be able to make it an informed decision, or at least know, you know. Like, maybe we should talk to a genetic counselor, you know, maybe we should talk to someone. But if you don't even know that there are genetic counselors because you've never encountered that in your life, then you're kind of.
You would think they would talk about that sometimes before pregnancy. Once you're pregnant.
There are
some. I mean, you're just, you know, you're not. It's it was just a weird thing. I think somehow if we could get people to think about those decisions before they got pregnant, so they knew it was coming at least.
Yeah, although a lot of things that. You know, some people are predisposed to certain things, like Tay-Sachs. If Tay-Sachs, that's a life-threatening condition that there's not any good treatment for in infants. So people where that runs in their family often get tested, even to determine if they're a carrier, and then make decisions about whether to have children, biological children at all. But a lot of things can happen. You have no predisposition to it. Trisomy 18. It just, when things recombine, when the sperm meets the egg and the chromosomes come together, you know, things happen and genetic abnormalities can happen that don't necessarily run in the family. So you can't always be screened at the time for things like that.
I think there's some procedures and things now that they're able to do for if they know of a defect. There's some procedures in utero that they're able to perform.
At the very least,
being prepared if this child is going to be born with certain defects, is having the staff and everybody available on hand to help out immediately after birth.
Sometimes a good
indication for doing the testing is being prepared.
Right. You can't take a gene out or a chromosome or things like that after the child is developing, but they're developing an abnormality such as spina bifida or something that can be corrected surgically. Or partially corrected surgically, as the fetus gets older, there is the capability now within the medical establishment to perform surgery in utero in some cases. So in that respect, if you knew about it early, you could think about those possibilities and that things could be, or immediately after birth, you know, immediately as soon as the child is delivered, correct that defect. But not, you know, not everything can be corrected surgically, but some things can certainly. Okay, so the next case study scenario is pre-symptomatic testing. So this would be testing a person that's already been born and, you know, is however many years old. So the case study that the opposing here is the Huntington's disease. Alright, so say your mother and all of her brothers die from Huntington's disease. And Huntington's disease is a later onset disease, a disease that people usually don't get until their 50s or 60s, sometimes earlier depending on. And this is caused by a repeat of three base pairs within a gene. And the more repeats you have in this specific gene, the earlier onset the disease is. If you have over a certain number, I think it's 35 or 36 repeats, you're almost certainly going to develop Huntington's disease, and then it depends on how many more of those repeats you have, how early you develop it, and it's a degenerative condition. Your nervous system and your muscular system degenerate over time, and there's no treatment. There are treatments, but they don't cure, and they don't come anywhere close to curing. So it's not a very pleasant way to die, or a very pleasant way to watch a loved one. So your mother and all her brothers died from Huntington's disease. Should you be tested? What are people think? Pros and cons? Why would you want to get tested if there's no cure?
Well, but I would think that would be one where you might not want to then give birth to your own biological children. You could be the one that stopped it.
Right, if you got tested before you were had born any children, you could make decisions about whether you would have children. But let's say before you really realize this is happening, you know, your mother and all of her brothers die in their 60s and 70s, and you've already had kids. So maybe you're thinking about getting tested in your 40s or your 30s, and you've already had children before you really realize that this was Huntington's disease and it was in your family. That's less likely to happen now than maybe 50 years ago, where often Huntington's disease wasn't properly diagnosed. People's brains start to be affected and they start to act as if they're experiencing dementia, and they lose their balance and walk funny. And it took a while before Huntington's disease was correctly diagnosed and was regularly correctly diagnosed. It was called a lot of other things, or, you know, Uncle Albert, he's, you know, kind of going off a little bit, and we don't really know what's causing it. So it's less likely that that would happen now, but, you know, a couple decades ago, it might take until your 40s to realize what was going on with Uncle Albert and Uncle Bob and your mom. So does anyone think there's a good reason to be tested?
I actually met this pretty much exact scenario where they didn't realize. They had three sons before they realized that all the uncles, you know, were dying from Huntington's disease. So they had their children tested, and now the father is exhibiting symptoms and everything like that. And two of the boys are now geneticists and searching for cures. So, like, in that instance, you know, they know that they have a very high disposition for it, and, you know, they're over that number, so it's very likely that they're going to get it, and they're trying to take steps towards preventing it in other people. And so, like, in that case, have them tested, so maybe there's a way to help the future.
Yeah, so that's a good example where you can try to do something proactive, sort of. And one of the scientists who was a leader of the team who finally identified the gene that causes Huntington's, this is sort of her scenario. Her mother and all of her mother's brothers died from Huntington's disease, and that very much influenced her career choice. And then she led a team that went down to South America, where there's a large percentage of a small, fairly contained population of people that had this disease, where they could draw blood and do genetic research. And they finally identified the single gene that causes Huntington's disease, or that, you know, has these extra repeats and results in Huntington's disease. And she wrote a book about it. Her name's Nancy Wexler. And in the book, there's a lot of discussion between herself and her sister about whether they should get tested. And at the end of the book, the culminating event is they discover which gene is responsible, so to speak, or has the faulty instructions in it. But they still haven't decided whether to get tested themselves. Mm-hmm. And they're sort of entering their 50s at this point. And so, kind of waiting. You can see two reasonable opinions, like, oh, I don't want to know, I just want to live my life and not worry about it. Or not knowing is going to drive me crazy for the next 2 or 3 decades. I'd rather just know. And you can see, you know, either side sort of makes sense, and it would be a personal decision.
There'd be some real concrete, I mean, I need to be this picky, but insurance, I mean, life insurance and health insurance.
Ethical issues, yeah.
Once you know that, and they ask you, you've got to say, yes, I know that, and all of a sudden you're not going to get.
Right, so that's the disclosure issue there on ethical questions, privacy. You know, the medical establishment knows this about you. Do you have to disclose it to your insurance agency? Can they search through computer records and find it, even though it's supposed to be confidential? You know, when's the appropriate time for testing? You know, is that something that should be up to the individual, or should other people be able to weigh in and say, I think you need to be tested? You know, there's certainly a lot of friction in Nancy Wexler's family between people, some of which saying, yeah, we should all get tested, or no, I don't want to know, and I don't want to know the results of your test because it might say something about me, mm-hmm. right? So when you get tested, when an individual gets tested for a genetic condition, it's not just giving information about that individual. It's giving potential information about that individual's parents, brothers, sisters, offspring. So other people may find out, learn information about themselves, which they may or may not want to know. So can you force that individual to disclose what the results are if you want to know, or can you force them to not disclose if you don't want to know? Tough questions. And, you know, insurance is a huge one. If your insurance company finds out that you're predisposed to Huntington's disease, what are they going to do? You want to think that they're not going to do anything bad to you, but reality teaches us that oftentimes that's not what happens. Okay, so the third scenario is a risk testing scenario. So there are a lot of alleles or sort of spellings of genes that can predispose you to a condition, but don't mean that you're for sure going to get it. So the case study I have here involves the BRCA1 gene, which, if misspelled in certain ways, can predispose one to developing breast cancer. But it's definitely not 100%. There are a whole range of ways that this gene can be misspelled. Some of them predispose more than others to breast cancer. So your grandmother, this scenario supposes that you're female, although males can develop breast cancer as well at a much lower probability. So your grandmother died of breast cancer. Your mother was diagnosed with breast cancer, as were your two aunts, your mother's sisters. They had radical surgery and chemo and are currently alive. They all carry BRCA1 mutations. So, you know, would you want to be tested or not? You know, a negative result doesn't mean you won't develop cancer from some other cause. I mean, cancer is a really complicated disease, which is why it's so hard to find a cure. Most cancers are believed to be caused by several different genetic misspellings that all combine to cause cells to grow out of control. It's not just one misspelling, necessarily. And even within the same type of cancer, like breast cancer, there's not just one genetic misspelling that can predispose you. There are other ones as well. And so it's not black and white, so to speak. And as I said, there are many BRCA1 gene spelling variations, and some carry an increased predisposition or risk to cancer, and some don't. So, you know, if this runs in your family, this BRCA1 misspelling, and numerous of your female relatives have contracted breast cancer, you know, what do you do? Do you want to be tested? Do you not want to be tested? Any opinions?
As a female, I definitely would, just because then you can be on the watch, and if breast cancer is caught early, the likelihood of surviving it is that much higher.
Mm-hmm. Right, so in this case, we're talking about a disease where there's not 100% cure for it, but there are some very good treatments. And as you said, if you know you have a predisposition, you can be screened more regularly, at least if you're affluent enough to have good health insurance and be able to either have those screenings be covered by insurance or be able to afford them out of your own pocket.
Mm-hmm. I know someone who had that exact scenario and was tested and chose to have a double mastectomy.
Right, prophylactic mastectomy, yeah. So that's another thing that you can choose to do, to remove that tissue before the disease even strikes.
I read some article about the family that their stomachs, and 11 people in the family had their stomachs removed because they were predisposed to having stomach
cancer.
And I mean, that radically changes your life, have your stomach removed, because you have to be, I don't know how they are fed, if it's all spontaneously or how it works.
Yeah, I have to.
Big change in lifestyle.
Right, I have to disclose that I'm not a clinician in any way, and I do basic genetic research, so I don't. So if clinical questions come up and someone else has more clinical experience, feel free to weigh in. I would presume that, I mean, some of your food is absorbed in the small and large intestine as well. So I don't know if they leave a very tiny bit of your stomach, or certainly you have to eat much smaller portions.
Yeah, and chew a lot more because the saliva itself
digests. Yeah, if you're not having that. The stomach is a very acidic environment, and the stomach muscles also do this. So, yeah, chewing your food much more and having a lot of that digestion take place up here before it goes down here would be important. But so there are treatments that one can choose, hopefully with a lot of information, so that you can make a really informed choice. And hopefully, in all these cases of testing, one of the best things would be hooked up with people that have been through this before, right? People that have already been through this. So support groups of people. That's an example of community, where community can really hold up the person that's really questioning and frightful and has to deal with all these things that they may have little or no information about. If you can hook people up with support groups of other individuals who've been through this problem, I think that can really provide a lot of support. It doesn't help them, it doesn't give them the answer that's right for them, but a lot of tools and information that they could use, more so than just reading a textbook on breast cancer or a textbook on Edwards syndrome. Talk to actual people. So, did we have enough time to deal with the last case scenario? And this is a case scenario that I pulled from a book, but similar things have happened in reality. So the book is called My Sister's Keeper by Jodi Picoult. And let me just, I'll give you the reality scenario first. So in 2000, I believe, a couple who had a daughter named Molly discovered that Molly had Fanconi's anemia, which is an incurable blood disease. The only treatment is bone marrow transplant if you can find a matched donor, which they could not. Neither the mother nor father was genetically matched enough to give a good prognosis for bone marrow transplant. So they decided to go, at that time, a really, well, and still, even a very sort of cutting-edge, high-tech way, which was to decide to have another child, which I believe they were planning on having more children anyway, but to decide to have another child and not in the, what would be called the in vivo way, the quote-unquote normal biological way of having a child, they decided to have in vitro fertilization, so the mother's egg, the father's sperm mixed in a dish, fertilization occurs in the dish, the cells divide, reach the blastocyst stage, at which time cells can be taken from each of the blastocysts and screened to determine whether the fetus that would grow from this blastocyst potentially would be genetically matched to their daughter Molly. And for tissue donation, like bone marrow transplant or kidney transplant or those kind of things, there are a whole host of proteins on the outside of your cell that signal your immune system to tell you that this cell belongs to you and isn't some foreign invader like a bacteria or a virus. Okay, so a genetic match involves numerous genes encoding numerous proteins. It's not just one single gene. So they screen these blastocysts for all these different, the genes encoding all these different proteins, and choose only the ones that match Molly, what Molly's got, so that when you put the cells into Molly, Molly's immune system goes, oh, that's just part of Molly, and doesn't try to reject that tissue. So, you know, they had 24 blastocysts, a number of them matched, and they implanted four into the mother. One attached in the uterus and grew to term, and she had a baby boy who's you can use umbilical cord blood as a. There are a lot of stem cells that are the cells that repopulate all the cells in your blood in the umbilical cord vein, the umbilical vein and the umbilical cord. And so that's a way slightly different than bone marrow transplant. Same type of cells, but they're in the umbilical vein. So that's not very invasive to the baby. It can be done right away. You don't have to wait for the baby to grow old enough to be able to take bone marrow out of the bones. So they used this umbilical vein, the stem cells from the umbilical vein, and transplanted them into Molly's bone marrow, and they reconstituted her with healthy blood cells. They had to kill all of her cells in her bone marrow, so I'm assuming she went for some sort of chemotherapy before they implanted her brother's cells in her, his name is Adam. And the last update I could find on Molly, looking on the internet, was from last year, and she's doing fine. She's a healthy 10 or 11-year-old.
Somebody was just telling me, I don't know if it was a movie or what, but similar situation where the parents had a child to get the bone marrow for their sick, you know, other kid, and they did the prenatal stuff of the, you know, this cord blood. But then as the kid got older, there was some relapses, and the donor child that they had given birth to, you know, had to keep providing for the sibling, and at one point, as they got older, even, took them to court.
Sued for medical emancipation.
Yeah.
So that's the book.
Okay, that's the book.
The book, My Sister's Keeper.
Okay.
So, now there are numerous ethical issues that you can think of here. Even with just in vitro fertilization, even you're not looking for a specific trait or trying to, because you can also screen things out in this procedure. So there's been quite a bit of controversy about whether it's okay to do in vitro fertilization and then screen for all the genes that we know predispose to cancer and don't use any of those embryos. Although, you know, there are a whole bazillion other diseases people can develop over their lifetime that cannot be screened out on the basis of genetic information.
Let's suppose the first child had a disease that they hadn't identified the gene for yet. What would be the risk of, you know, if they pick a genetic match, that they're going to end up with two children with that disease?
Well, that's a...
That would be a risk.
That could be a potential risk that the children would have some other disease. Fanconi's anemia is caused by a genetic abnormality. So they could pick blastocysts that did not have that, but did match
But not all diseases have they identified the gene.
Sure, right. And that, so that's what I was sort of saying. You can come down with some other disease that has nothing to do with genetics at any time in your life, depending on what kind of environment you're in and what you become exposed to as far as viruses, bacteria, things of that sort. So right, there are no guarantees. But is it ethically permissible or okay to, you know, decide to have your child in vitro or to conceive your child in vitro and then screen for or against all these other things? There was a case in Britain where parents wanted to choose a female embryo or a female blastocyst that was developing female embryos because they had four sons and one daughter, and their daughter was killed in a tragic accident, and they wanted to have another daughter. And Britain has a board that oversees these kind of things, and they ruled against it. They said you can't choose the gender of your child. But then in a more recent article, that same board from Britain has ruled that fertility clinics may screen out human embryos carrying genes that raise the risk of cancer in adulthood, a move the government said could prevent future suffering, but that others said was proof that the age of hand-picked designer babies is at hand. And this body, governing body, is called the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority. We don't have anything like that in this country. And so people who do in vitro fertilization do have the ability to screen for or against certain things, and there's sort of no, as far as I understand it, it's up to the doctor and the people undergoing the procedure to decide. There aren't any rules, legal or otherwise, for what you can screen for. So to get back to the case study, so in the case study, Brian and Sarah are the parents, and they have a daughter named Kate and a son named Jesse. And when Kate's 5 and Jesse's 2, Kate's diagnosed with APL, which is acute promyelocytic leukemia, so that's cancer of the blood cells, the white blood cells. And same thing, they can't find a good genetic match within their family, or, you know, you can look through the whole, there's a big database, right, you can be typed, and they can't find anybody that's a good match. So they decide to do the same thing, have in vitro fertilization and screen for a child who's a match. And they do that. And they have a third child, a daughter named Anna. And so their intention is that the cord blood from Anna will be transplanted into Kate and affect the cure of her leukemia. But the cure is not permanent, and Kate continues to need things from Anna. And finally, at age 13, Anna sues for medical emancipation. And so we don't have time to go through. The thing I love about this book is that it's written from the point of view of all the players. Different chapters are from different points of view. So there's the father's point of view, the mother's point of view, Kate's point of view, Jesse, the son's point of view, Anna's point of view, Anna's lawyer's point of view, and after Anna sues, she's appointed a guardian ad litem who's supposed to look only for her, only at what's best for Anna. And so her point of view is represented as well. So you really get a feeling for all the vast range of emotion on the in the case of the parents and the siblings and the sort of the major players themselves, the sick child and the child who's conceived in order to cure the sick child. And so when Anna walks into this lawyer's office, his name is Campbell Alexander, she walks into his office and says, you know, I want to retain you as my lawyer. I want to sue my parents for medical emancipation. And so she describes to him her situation, and what she says is, on the other hand, I was born for a very specific purpose. I wasn't the result of a cheap bottle of wine or a full moon or the heat of the moment. I was born because a scientist managed to hook up my mother's eggs and my father's sperm to create a specific combination of precious genetic material. And then later she says, the first time I gave something to my sister, it was cord blood, and I was a newborn. She has leukemia, APL, and my cells put her into remission. The next time she relapsed, I was 5, and I had lymphocytes drawn from me 3 times over because the doctors never seemed to get enough the first time around. Because lymphocytes are the white blood cells in your blood, and they're much less numerous than the red blood cells. So you have to draw out a fair amount of blood to get a large number of lymphocytes. And for a kid, kids got less blood, right, smaller volume to start with, so five-year-old. When that stopped working, they took bone marrow for a transplant. Okay, so that's an invasive procedure where they go right into the marrow of your bone and aspirate out cells. In the last few years, that's changed because now there are some drugs that can stimulate your bone marrow to produce stem cells, and those stem cells exit into the periphery, so you can sort of supercharge the bone marrow, and they spit out all these stem cells, and they can be collected just from the blood. Mm-hmm. So that can be done now. But for this scenario, it was needle into the bone marrow, which is supposed to be quite painful. When Kate got infections, I had to donate granulocytes. That's another type of white blood cell. When she relapsed again, I had to donate peripheral blood stem cells. So those are the stem cells that come out of the bone marrow that are circulating around. And then the lawyer says, the girl's medical vocabulary would put some of my paid experts to shame. I pull a legal pad out of a drawer. Obviously, you've agreed to be a donor for your sister before. She hesitates, then shakes her head. Nobody ever asked. Did you tell your parents you don't want to donate a kidney? So this is what it's come to her. Sister's kidneys are failing because of her disease, and she needs a kidney in order to survive. They don't listen to me. They might if you mention this. She looks down so that her hair covers her face. They don't really pay attention to me, except when they need my blood or something. I wouldn't even be alive if it wasn't for Kate being sick. So, just from the basis of that quote, you get a certain perspective, right? And since Anna is one of the major players in this book, she has many, many chapters and many opportunities to describe her feelings. So you see the full range of her feelings, how much she loves her sister, how much she loves her parents. You know, it doesn't all come through in just this one statement here. She's kind of angry, and she's decided she's going to take this step. You know, to be medically emancipated would mean that they would have to ask her, you know, will you donate a kidney to your sister? And she has the right to say, yes, I will, or no, I'm going to choose not to do that. And you can tell from what she says that one of the things that is bugging her is that she's never really been directly asked, do you want to do this? It's always been more like, well, we need this for your sister, so of course, off we go to the hospital, you know, to isolate granulocytes from you or whatever. And then Kate, who's kind of the other side of this equation, sick child providing biological components for the sick child, the guardian ad litem goes to talk to Kate and asks her the question, what do you want to be when you grow up? And she says, no one ever asks me that. What makes you think I'm going to grow up? So she's, you know, all she remembers practically, at this point she's 15 or 16, so since she's 5, she's been critically ill, you know, going to the hospital over and over when she has relapses or problems. You know, she's bald from chemotherapy. She's got IVs that are shunts that are permanently in her body. She can't go to school normally, you know, to normal school because of risk of infection. So, you know, she has a lot of issues of her own. And then another time when there's going to be a dance for patients at the hospital, like a prom for teenage patients that can't go to the regular prom. And Kate kind of has a boyfriend, this boy named Taylor, who has not the same disease as her, but another form of cancer of the blood. And Kate's kind of ambivalent about going to this dance, and her mother says, don't you think every other girl who's going to that dance is in the same boat, trying to find gowns to cover up tubes and bruises and wires and colostomy bags and God knows what? I don't care about anyone else, Kate says. I want it to look good, really good, you know, for one night. Taylor already thinks you're beautiful. Well, I don't, Kate cries. I don't, Mom, and maybe I want to just once. Sorry, I'm crying. I mean, you can see how she feels, you know, like, I'm sick of being sick. I'm sick of being different. I'm sick of not having a normal life. And she and Anna are really quite close. They love each other very much. And so the whole thing is difficult for both of them. And I'm not going to give away the end of the book in case anybody wants to read it, but later on in the book it comes out that Kate supports Anna's decision to do what she's doing. So it's not like, you know, she's mad at her, oh, you're suing for medical emancipation and you might not give me a kidney. She actually supports her, unbeknownst to her parents. They've had a conversation or two about this issue.
What's the name of the book again?
My Sister's Keeper. There are several copies in the bookstore. And here's an instance where, I'm almost out of time, where Sarah, the Kate and Anna's mom, is talking to Campbell Alexander. They're in the courtroom. They're in the midst of the trial. You think you can lay it out in all out in words, black and white, as if it's that easy. But you only represent one of my daughters, Mr. Alexander, and only in this courtroom. I represent both of them equally everywhere, every place. I love both of them equally everywhere, every place. Alexander says, but you admitted that you've always considered Kate's health, not Anna's, in making these choices. So how can you plan to love both of them equally? How can you say that you haven't been favoring one child in your decisions? And then Sarah replies, aren't you asking me to do that very thing, only this time to favor the other child? And so you can see some of her conflict. You know, she desperately wants to save Kate. And that involves using parts of Anna. How do you know when to stop? How do you know when, you know, obviously in the beginning they thought the cord blood thing would be the trick and that would be it. It's not invasive to the newborn child. You know, that would be great. And I don't have time to go through, you know, but there are quotes from all the other players, you know, the guardian ad litem, when she's asked by the judge, what's your recommendation? She says, for the first time I've ever served as a guardian ad litem, I'm unable to reach a recommendation. And she likens the scenario to, she says, it's a Solomon's choice, Your Honor, but you're not asking me to split a baby in half, you're asking me to split a family. So she is having trouble deciding even what's best for Anna in this situation. You know, Jesse, the brother, gets largely ignored because it's all about Kate and Anna, and he's off acting out, doing all sorts of stuff, drinking and taking drugs and just sort of desperate negative behavior, pleas for attention from his family. And so some of going through this whole trial forces them to face some of that too, what's going on with their son. So, you know, we've touched on some of the ethical issues. One question is, do parents have an obligation, legal or moral, to seek treatment for their children, to seek a cure no matter what it entails? So is it a valid argument to say that they should do this? They should absolutely do the in vitro fertilization and select for a potential match for their daughter. Is that something that even someone who sued them and say, you have to do that, you have to find a match? Or is it sort of above and beyond what parents are ethically required to do? You know, some parents, on the basis of their religious or other views, choose not to seek treatment for various conditions that their children have, and sometimes they're forced legally to seek those treatments, often life-saving treatments.
There was a case last week or the week before in Seattle where the mother, she had a 9-month-old son who needed it. Treatment to save his
life. And she took off
and
with him.
Basically the court took her out of the picture and was going to force it, so she kidnapped her own son.
And that happened right around the time we left to come to work, so I didn't know what the result was.
Yeah, there was an Amber Alert out, and they found the baby, and they brought it back, and she was put in jail. I mean, they brought her down, they got her gunpoint and everything, and they finally released her from jail. But the court ruled that the surgery had to go forward, so they forced the surgery.
Right, so that's true. Yeah, the Amber Alert was going on as we were driving to Chelan. It was flashing on the signs on the highway. And so I hadn't heard whether they found the child.
They found the child. They arrested her. From the gun. They had a gun pointed.
What was the surgery? What was it for?
It was kidney failure, something. It was the doctor said it. The baby would die if it didn't get this.
And
the mother wanted a different alternative type of treatment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, see, I totally got. You know, that's the thing with the news, it drives me nuts, because they give you this little blurb,
and you don't have
all the information.
Yeah, the doctor said it was not, did not need to do it to save the child's life.
Right, because of course the way they say it on the news is like, this child's only got hours to live, and that minus, and that's a little bit, you know, that's a little bit different than,
right.
This is the established medical procedure for this, but this person is interested in an alternative procedure or something like that.
But they did let her out of jail, which is a good thing.
Exactly.